Israeli intelligence has played a vital part in the Jewish homeland's struggle for national survival. Since Israel's birth in 1948, its national intelligence services, loosely known as the Mossad, combined intellectual leadership with a ruthlessness that has impressed both friends and enemies. The Mossad has a worldwide reach. Its willingness to use extreme methods like kidnapping and assassination to pursue enemies is legendary. The truth behind some of the Mossad's operations is more remarkable than fiction. May 14, 1948, Israel's statehood was proclaimed. The next day, Israel was invaded by its Arab neighbors. It took more than 6 months of fighting and some 6,000 casualties before the new state could be sure of survival. A casualty of the war was the Jewish intelligence service. Under the leadership of Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, it was disbanded. Its functions were divided among three new agencies. Military intelligence was to be handled by a directorate known as Amon. An agency called the Political Department was formed within the Foreign Ministry. Its job was collecting military, political, and economic intelligence outside Israel's borders. A third function was provided by the General Security Service, or Shin Bet. It was headed by Isser Harold, who was given the task of coordinating the activities of the new agencies. Harold was influenced by post-war American intelligence, in particular the 1947 formation of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. This led to the creation of Israel's Central Institute for Intelligence and Special Duties, or Mossad, which replaced the Foreign Ministry's Political Department. Harold was appointed as its head in September 1952. The Mossad became synonymous with Israeli intelligence. Prime Minister Ben-Gurion promptly increased the Mossad's budget tenfold. The war of 1948 left Israel surrounded by Arab foes. Intelligence would play a crucial role in the new nation's political and military strategy. Israel's uniquely efficient citizen army was backed by an effective intelligence network. All over the world, people were available to provide information or spy on suspected enemies. In 1956, this network provided the Mossad with a copy of the secret speech denouncing Stalin made by Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev at the 20th Communist Party Congress. The Mossad passed its copy of the speech to the CIA, which was impressed by the new agency's ability. By the early 1960s, Israel's Mossad had placed key agents within Egypt and Syria. The first was Wolfgang Lotz, born in Germany in 1921. His mother, an actress, was Jewish. She had emigrated to Palestine with her small son in 1933, the year Adolf Hitler came to power. In Palestine, Wolfgang became fluent in English, Hebrew, and Arabic. During World War II, he served with the British Army in the Western Desert. After the war, he fought with the Haganah and the Israeli army. Lotz was picked by the Mossad as the ideal man to infiltrate the upper reaches of Egyptian society. He not only looked German, his papers confirmed it. His cover story in Egypt was that he served with Rommel, not the Eighth Army. Lotz blended easily into the lush life of Egypt's international set. The contacts Lotz made gave him access to Egyptian politics at the highest level. He gathered information on Egypt's armed forces and radioed it back to his controllers in Israel. Lotz was undone by growing suspicions among Nasser's Soviet military advisors that a spy had penetrated the upper reaches of Egypt's military. Lotz's radio transmissions from Cairo were traced, and he was arrested and tried in 1965. The Egyptians did not know he was an Israeli and could not break down his story that he was a German working for Israeli intelligence. He was sentenced to life in prison. In 1968, he was freed and exchanged for 9 Egyptian generals captured in the Six-Day War. Later, Lotz described the radio hidden in some bathroom scales. It was his lengthy transmissions that betrayed him to Egyptian intelligence. The second Israeli master spy of the early 1960s was Eli Cohen, the son of 2 Syrian Jews who emigrated to Israel in 1956. The Mossad devised the cover of a successful Beiruti businessman, Kamal Amin Tabet, for Cohen. In the Arab community of Buenos Aires, he successfully passed as an Arab. In 1962, Cohen arrived in Damascus, the capital of Syria. He began to move in wealthy and influential circles. He broadcast regularly on Syrian radio and joined the ruling Ba'ath Party. Cohen gave Israeli intelligence a complete plan of Syrian defenses on the strategically vital Golan Heights. Cohen also gave his handlers the Syrian order of battle and a breakdown of the Syrian armed forces' weapons inventories. Cohen was operating his radio when he was arrested by Syrian intelligence. Tried in secret, he was found guilty and sentenced to a public hanging in Damascus. The scandal in Syria brought down the government. Top spy master Meir Amit, who headed Mossad, and General Aharon Yariv, his counterpart at Amon, kept the Israeli government well informed. Working with them was Yuval Ne'eman, a scientist who applied his expertise to gathering military intelligence. Ne'eman had foreseen the key role computers would play in intelligence gathering and analysis. By the beginning of the 1960s, Israel had a computer-linked electronic warning system that rivaled the best in the world. The rewards of this sophisticated system came in the crucial opening hours of the Six-Day War, in the early morning of June 5, 1967. The precision and power of preemptive Israeli airstrikes launched against Egypt that morning were one of the greatest intelligence triumphs of the post-war years. The first wave of Israeli fighter bombers executed a plan based on detailed intelligence. The outcome of the war was decided within hours. The Israelis struck when the Egyptians were at their most vulnerable. Between 7:30 and 8 in the morning, Egyptian radar operators would be at the end of their shifts and tired. Air crews would be eating breakfast. Aircraft would be awaiting maintenance, and senior officers would be caught in Cairo's rush hour. In just over 3 hours, the Israelis destroyed 300 of Egypt's 340 airworthy warplanes. With total air supremacy, the Israelis then annihilated the Egyptian armored forces in the Sinai. In less than 4 days, the Israelis broke an Egyptian army of 100,000, shattered the Syrians, and seized the Golan Heights. It was a victory secured by superb leadership at every level. Thanks to intelligence, of the highest quality. The Israelis made only one serious intelligence blunder. Their aircraft and torpedo boats launched a damaging attack on the Liberty, a U.S. Navy ship just off the Sinai coast. It had been gathering electronic intelligence on both Israeli and Egyptian forces. 34 American sailors died. In spite of the Liberty incident, the CIA saw the Six-Day War as evidence of the excellence of Israeli intelligence. This was confirmed in 1979 after Iranian revolutionaries took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Over 100 embassy staff and U.S. Marines were taken hostage. Embassy officials had attempted to shred documents, but remarkably, the Iranians pieced them back together. CIA paperwork among them stated, "Israel's intelligence services are among the best in the world, with an outstanding ability to evaluate information obtained from recruited agents, Jewish communities, and other sources throughout the world." One of the Nazis most heavily involved in carrying out the Final Solution was Adolf Eichmann. This bureaucrat of death had signed many of the documents meticulously filed by the SS. Eichmann had organized the transportation of millions to the gas chambers. But amid the chaos at the end of the war in Europe, with millions of prisoners and refugees on the move, Eichmann had slipped away and disappeared. Some 15 years later, a Mossad squad slipped secretly into Buenos Aires. Their target was an Argentine businessman of German extraction, Richard Clement. His house was watched for weeks. Then, on May 11th, 1960, agents followed a bus Clement was taking home. As Clement waited for his connection, four men grabbed him and hustled him into a car. He was rushed to a hideout, protesting he didn't understand what was going on. Then the agents checked his medical details, put an SS cap on his head, and compared them to this photo. They had finally caught Eichmann. He was given the choice between instant death or standing trial, and agreed to go to Israel. He was smuggled aboard an LL flight to Tel Aviv. The announcement of his arrest caused a worldwide sensation. Eichmann was put on trial on April 11, 1961. His defense could not explain away the wealth of incriminating documents and eyewitness accounts of his brutality. After an eight-month trial, Eichmann was found guilty and condemned to hang. On September 5, 1972, a group of Black September terrorists broke into the Israeli dormitory in Munich's Olympic Village. In the murderous confusion that followed, nine Israeli athletes were taken prisoner. Others were gunned down in a hail of automatic fire. When the shooting stopped, negotiations with German officials began. The world watched as a tense drama played out on this balcony. Black September demanded the release of 200 Palestinians held in Israeli jails and safe passage out of Germany. The Germans agreed to the demands. Waiting for them were marksmen from Germany's special forces who had previously taken their positions. The ambush collapsed in confusion. The captors killed all the hostages the moment they realized they had walked into a trap. Aftershocks from the horribly botched rescue operation would be felt for a long time. But even as Black September's victims were being laid to rest, the Mossad was planning retaliation. The Israeli government established a special committee, designated Committee X, chaired by Prime Minister Golda Meir and Defense Minister Moshe Dayan. Black September terrorists responsible for the deaths of the Israeli athletes were to be ruthlessly hunted down. Under the Mossad's operations chief, Mike Harari, several hit squads were formed. The first hit was made in October 1972 on Veil Abdul Zvater, head of the Black September operations in Italy. In a year, 10 targets were assassinated, all of them prominent Palestinians. In 1976, the Mossad faced another choice. Palestinian terrorists hijacked an Air France jet and flew to Entebbe Airport in Uganda. 97 passengers were held hostage. Most were Jewish. Many were Israeli citizens. Shimon Peres was Israel's defense minister. After protracted negotiations failed, a hit team of commandos flew from Israel in three Hercules transports. Kenya agreed to provide refueling on the return journey. The three aircraft flew low and close in an attempt to look like one radar signature and came in over Lake Victoria. Mossad agents had already confirmed the hostages were in an isolated old terminal building right of the runway. They reached the old terminal building without confrontation. But as commandos raced to secure the building, Ugandan troops or hijackers opened fire from the control tower. The leader of the raid, Lieutenant Yonatan Netanyahu, elder brother of Israel's future prime minister, was fatally wounded. He was the only Israeli casualty. In 1973, cracks began to appear in Israel's intelligence services. Amon rejected assessments of an Egyptian surprise attack as inaccurate. The subsequent Yom Kippur War almost destroyed the nation. During the 1980s, popular and political support for the Mossad and Shin Bet declined. They were accused of resorting to torture to combat the Intifada, the Palestinian revolt against Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. During these operations, clandestine Arab-speaking units codenamed Sherry and Samson had gone undercover to stalk Palestinians. Uncomfortable questions about their methods were raised. Perhaps even more serious, Israeli intelligence placed its relationship with U.S. intelligence in jeopardy, particularly with the CIA, which had been supportive for a quarter of a century. In 1966, when General Mordecai Hoad announced that an Iraqi defector had landed in Israel with a Soviet-supplied MiG-21, this information was immediately shared with the U.S. In the late 1960s, technical documents on the French Mirage fighter were acquired by Israel from a Swiss engineer. They were given to the U.S. and fed into the homegrown fighter program of the Israeli Air Force. But the U.S.-Israeli relationship was rocked in 1981. Israel failed to tell Washington about its plans for a preemptive strike on an Iraqi nuclear reactor at Osirak. The reactor was on the edge of producing weapons-ready material for the Iraqi nuclear program. Israel showed that when its national interests were at stake, it was capable of ruthless action. Even more damaging to its relationship with the U.S. was the Pollard affair of the mid-1980s. An Israeli agent, Jonathan Pollard, was unmasked within U.S. naval intelligence. In the early 1980s, Pollard, a U.S. naval intelligence officer, traveled to Paris. where he was recruited as an agent by LACM, Israel's ultra-secret science liaison bureau. Its principal role was to safeguard Israel's nuclear weapons program. Hollard was sentenced to life in prison. In spite of repeated Israeli appeals for his release, he remains behind bars. In 1986, another operation revealed the willingness of Israeli intelligence agencies to operate outside the law. In London, the Sunday Times printed a scoop about Israel's nuclear program. The source was Mordecai Vanunu, who had been a technician at the highly classified Israeli nuclear facility at Dimona in the Negev Desert. The Israelis developed some 200 nuclear weapons at Dimona in a program whose existence they vehemently denied. Frustrated by the Sunday Times' delay in running the story, Vanunu decided to fly to Rome. Unfortunately, he had chosen to travel with an attractive female companion named Cindy. Cindy was more than just a friend. She was a Mossad agent. Perhaps the Sunday Times should have taken greater care of Mordecai Vanunu. In Rome, Cindy's plans were well laid. A Mossad team moved into the city and began to trail the couple. Vanunu was overpowered in his hotel room, drugged, taken aboard a yacht, and transported to Israel. There, the former Dimona lab technician was tried in secret. When Vanunu arrived at court on the first day of the trial, he found a way to tell the waiting press what had happened. News of his abduction by Mossad was broadcast to the world's press by a message scrawled on his palm. In the trial that followed, Vanunu was found guilty and sentenced to 18 years in prison. The affair was an international sensation and did little to quiet concerns about the earlier misjudgments by Israeli intelligence. Soon those services would be faced with unforeseen problems closer to home. In the 1990s, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's determination to move toward reconciliation with the PLO split Israeli society as never before. Shin Bet failed to anticipate how far right-wing fanatics would go to stop him. On the night of November 4, 1995, minutes after Rabin appeared at a peace rally in Tel Aviv, an assassin struck. Yigal Amir was immediately seized by Rabin's bodyguards, but the fatal shots had been fired. At his trial, an unrepentant Amir emerged as a militant critic of the peace process Rabin initiated with the PLO. Eerily, the crime was reconstructed. Amir had also intended to kill Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, but Peres left the rally by another route. Amir made sure he shot an unprotected Rabin. The Mossad could still act with its old flair. Canadian scientist Gerald Bull was a brilliant maverick in the world of ballistics and the brains behind the remarkable Supergun project. On his privately owned Caribbean proving ground, Bull created a real-life version of a James Bond thriller. He had developed an immensely powerful gun by combining two 16-inch Navy barrels. Bull moved to a proving ground on the U.S.-Canadian border. He boasted that he could fire a shell from Montreal to Mexico City. There was a buyer for the supergun, Saddam Hussein. Iraq's dictator had seen his nuclear weapons program at Osirik attacked by the Israeli Air Force. Saddam placed an order for Bull's supergun. Saddam had been impressed by howitzers developed by Bull and acquired by the Iraqis from South Africa and Austria. The supergun would allow him to reach Israel. The Mossad watched carefully. In return for buying the supergun, Saddam demanded that Bull help Iraq design a multi-stage missile using his old Russian-supplied Scuds. This was too much for the Mossad, which had been told by Bull himself about the Supergun project. The Scuds were a greater threat than the Supergun. The Mossad warned Bull, but he chose to ignore them. In March 1990, a team of Mossad hitmen staked out Gerald Bull's apartment in Brussels, the center of his arms-dealing industry. Assassins were waiting for him when he returned. He took the elevator to his apartment. As with Ali Hassan Saleme, there would be no mistake. As Bull emerged from the elevator and fumbled with his key, he was killed by five shots to the back of the head. No one heard the shots. No one was ever caught. Without Bull, the Supergun project, codenamed Babylon, collapsed. In the late 1980s, Israeli intelligence made a quantum leap in how it monitored its Arab neighbors. It launched the first of its OFEC satellites, designed for high-resolution surveillance of the Middle East. For Israeli intelligence, the battle for supremacy had moved into space. On the ground, however, the Middle East remained a powder keg that demanded constant vigilance. Accurate intelligence, analyzed to draw correct conclusions and take appropriate and often brutal actions, is as critical in creating the peace in the Middle East as it was in making war. Territory fought over for so long has exacted a terrible price from Israel and its enemies. But as the century ended, the possibility of peace seemed to improve. For more than 50 years, the need to protect Israel from surrounding enemies made its intelligence agencies more ruthless than those of any other country. With the possibility of peace, they will need to adapt to a new and possibly more complex world.